to the Right to Reason podcast. I'm your host, Robert Stanley. There's a lot of fear happening right now. Lots of uncertainty. Risk equals opportunity. We can focus on our news feeds, phones, phobias, and other outside sensational phenomena, or we can take this occasion to look inward. Now, as a needed break and breath, we are investigating meditation and mysticism.
It's the Right to Reason podcast.
This episode of the Right to Reason podcast is brought to you by our patrons and contributors like me. We have all recognized the value of the unrestrained marketplace of ideas and have decided to make a difference. You can make a difference too. Contribute at patreon.com/right and learn more about your right to reason at therighttoreason.com. Your activism is appreciated.
Andrew Jasko, Master of Divinity, Doctorate of Clinical Psychology in Progress, is a former Christian minister turned spiritual activist and religious trauma healer who teaches about the integration of psychology, spirituality, and sacred and secular traditions. You can find him at lifeafterdogma.org. Andrew, it's so great to have you back, man.
Great to be here.
I have had the craziest experience since the last time I talked to you. My mindfulness practices, my meditation practices, I was about to say they've doubled. Man, it's more like they've tripled or quadrupled. I don't even know how you quantify this kind of thing, but it's just, they've increased so much. And I chalk that up to two big reasons. There was the episode that you were on with Michael Moore. I don't replay a lot of my episodes myself, but that one, I play that actually fairly regularly. It was fantastic. A lot of the stuff you said, and Mike too, it gave me the tools that I needed to improve my mindfulness and meditative practices. Another one, I had a job where I was having to be up really high and dealing with the fear of heights while trying to keep myself under control. It was like as if it forced me. Like, you know how like soccer players will use a training goal that's smaller than the game goal?
Uh-huh.
It forced me to get better at it in those moments. I have found so much value in practicing at that. You know, I was trying to explain to someone the other day, they're like, so are you there yet? Do you have it? And I'm like, I don't think you ever get there.
That's absolutely right. I mean, we're talking about a lifelong or even eternal kind of process here. And I think it's really important when we're talking about spiritual growth and psychological healing to take a process view that we're always arriving and we're never there. And it's not the point to really get there. It's a point to accept that we are on a journey and we're on a path.
Yeah. You know, another one that I kind of tied together, and I don't know when it hit me, but I was having a moment of meditation. I was actually sitting in the garage, which most people might find that kind of weird, but I find the challenge of ambient sounds to actually force me to, I don't want to say make more effort, because that almost goes the other way. Then you're trying to meditate. Then you're actually doing the thing that, you know, it gets all discombobulated in your brain. But just having these random sounds, birds chirping, cars going by, what have you, I almost appreciate that challenge. And I'm sitting there meditating. The wife comes out and she's like, what are you doing? You got a headache or something? You know, and I wasn't like, oh, but you know, I was just sitting in my chair, eyes closed. And I said, no, I was just meditating. I said, it hit me. You know, all those times that I was praying as a Christian, that's the same place I get to, you know, not in some weird, like, you know, supernatural spiritualism or what have you, depending on how you might use that term. It can be confusing, but definitely, like, it's very similar. Is that a weird thing to hear? Or would you say that kind of lines up with your experience as well?
That definitely lines up with my experience somewhat. Although for me, prayer was always more about kind of attachment and craving and clinging and trying to get to some kind of a desired outcome. Whereas meditation is almost the opposite in my experience, in that I'm letting go of all that and just allowing and observing without judgment or expectation. But I think you're absolutely right in that prayer, centering prayer, can get to the same kinds of places. And so I like how you started this out talking about your experiences, because that's the heart of mysticism. I mean, we're going to have an intellectual conversation in many regards, and I love that. Like, the intellect is one of my favorite places to live, but really we can miss the heart of what we're calling mysticism or spirituality, depending on how you want to frame it, when we focus on the intellect, because it's a radically experientially focused point of view, and it prioritizes experience. So with mysticism, if you're satisfied with an intellectual description apart from experience, it's kind of like eating the menu at a five-star restaurant instead of the food. Mm. You know, you're missing the whole point. So I think we can talk about the menu today, but don't eat it. You know, these are some options and ways of framing the experience. And another word for mystical experience is gnosis, and this comes out of the Gnostic tradition, which is a mystical tradition, but it basically means direct experiential encounter. And what we're talking about here really blends the conventional boundaries between religion, spirituality, and the secular and scientific, and draws from all of them. So I think it's a really integrative and important conversation to have. And just for us to recognize, it's not something that's entirely made up. It refers to real experiences that people have from all kinds of different traditions. And so if this isn't something you're accustomed to, or you might have some reservations about, maybe just having that openness that if you ever start having these kinds of these experiences, you know, here are some places we can look. Here are some traditions that have been studying and practicing them for thousands of years. And I often hear people saying when they start having these experiences, I know I said this, like, this sounds crazy. You won't believe this. And just because it's weird doesn't mean it's not real or that it's not true, because the framework that we were raised in a lot of Western or philosophically materialist societies tends to discount these types of experiences as related to mental illness or schizophrenia or just purely creations of the mind. So people think that when they're having them, like, you can't even talk about them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you'll immediately face some kind of social consequence if you share that facet of your experience. I want to ask you something here, because you tapped into something when you said that similarity between meditation and prayer. You said it was like you were trying to do something. You're working towards something with prayer, and that's not your experience. And I often find that is mine, and it's so distracting, Andrew. It's so distracting because I think I do stay in the intellectual side of it a little bit more like the Sam Harris style meditation. I'm sure you've heard some of his stuff, and it's very helpful. But I also feel like I'm on the third floor of a skyrise building. How would you recommend someone get past that part?
Yeah, I think maybe just diving into some of the traditions and frameworks that have been proposed that I don't really hear Sam Harris talking about. They have a very rich history of empirical study and observation. I mean, here we can describe mysticism in some regards as a science of consciousness. And Buddhism does a great job, and so does yogic psychology or approaches within Hindu psychospirituality. They've developed psychospiritual technologies of consciousness and of mystical experiences. And we can approach matters of consciousness empirically as if they could describe objective reality. And so Buddhism basically does this, is they chart out these vast terrains of human experiencing and of experiencing the blending of subjective and objective reality as if there might be a deeper reality to them. And so this is the thing about a mystical experience, is that it's mysterious. And we might even argue it's transpersonal or beyond the individuated self and beyond symbolic linguistic representation. So an observation that's been made is that there's realms of experiencing that transcend the mind, that literally go beyond your idea of a separate ego personality self, which we tend to define ourselves by our thinking intellectual self, because we haven't been trained or accustomed to contemplative practices that allow us to access other aspects of reality. And these are really beyond conceptualization. And all these frameworks that we're talking about, mystical frameworks, really fall outside of a traditional Western philosophical materialist monistic perspective, which basically says that the material realm, matter, is the only stuff that exists. And a lot of these perspectives fall on more of the idealist perspective, which is saying that, or not even just the idealist perspective, what we might call a non-dual perspective, which we can get into a little bit later, but it's saying that there are realms and dimensions of existence that can't be neatly categorized as material, and that really, so basically consciousness, or what some people might call spirit or spirituality, is an aspect of our being, our consciousness or our awareness that goes beyond the thinking self. It goes beyond the realm of separation. And so really, we might not even be able to categorize it and really quantify it intellectually, because it's almost outside of that realm in a manner of speaking.
Is it fair to say that consciousness is an emergent property of the material world? Would that be some common ground we could find there?
So a philosophical materialist position would say that consciousness is an epiphenomenon of matter, that basically matter is all that it is. And an idealist perspective would say that matter is an emergent property of consciousness. Or not just that it's an emergent property, but that it is basically like consciousness condensed. It still is consciousness, but in a different form. Or really, when we're talking about matter and consciousness, these are our own linguistic categories, and they're not really separate in a manner of speaking. So this is an empirical, experiential observation of mystical traditions. And again, they approach mystical reality or reality with the eye of contemplation, which I argue a materialist framework has amputated its mystical eye. Like, we've literally been taught that these things don't exist, that spirituality doesn't exist, that it's all an emergent property of the material world. And so there's a branch of idealist philosophy called non-duality, which is mainly proposed by the cosmo-philosophical school of Advaita Vedanta. And non-duality says that there is a kind of a deeper aspect of reality that is undivided. There's no separation between subject, object, or perception. That in non-duality literally means not two. There's no separation and no division. And this isn't really possible to prove, but it's reproducible, our ability to access this state. And it's also known as nirvana in Buddhism. It's one of the major limbs of yogic practice. And it can also be accessed through psychedelic drugs or just pure meditation. And so let me give an example. I can't prove to you that our dream world isn't the primary reality. Like, can you actually prove that when we're asleep, that that's not more real than our waking consciousness?
I think so. I mean, it seems like that doesn't have confirmation from others, for one thing. So that's something I could say, like, this reality, you know, I'm looking at my cup of coffee and you're looking at my cup of coffee. You can confirm back to me the coffee is there. But in the dream state, I mean, I don't know. I don't want to get all solipsistic, you know, but unless I'm creating other people in this reality like I do in my dream world, then the dream world has no confirmation coming back to me.
That's right. So there are really good arguments and reasons to believe that this realm is, in a sense, more real, or at least more primary than the dream world, right? We can make a really good case for that. But you can't, like, 100% prove it.
Right, right.
And so this applies to non-duality, or the non-dual realm of experience, in that people who experience it, and also other mystical states of consciousness, will tend to say that it has this subjective quality of being more real than waking consciousness. That it's kind of like waking up to this more ultimate realm of reality that's a backdrop of existence. These deep, transcendent, life-transforming experiences of the ultimate, or what some people will call the divine or God, or different words. But it's really an empirical observation.
I love Douglas Harding, where he kind of presents this concept of, I have no head. And it blew my mind when I first heard it. I'm like, that's stupid. Of course I have a head. I can kind of see the nose because I got a big nose. I can kind of see my nose coming off my face, you know, like I can look into a mirror. I can touch my head with my hand. You know, what a dumb thing to say. But the point isn't so on the nose as it sounds. He's just saying, actually, no, your conscious state can't see your own head. And that's who you really are, is you are this conscious state. You think you're a body, but obviously, you know, we all know that if I cut my hand off, I don't think like that's me laying over on, you know, next to the saw, you know, that hand, that's no longer me. Well, you know, how much can you cut away from yourself before you start realizing that you are this state of consciousness? You are this state of experience. I feel like it's almost dangerous. This non-dualism stuff you're talking about, idealism, what have you.
Mm-hmm.
I'll talk to my dad. He's a big pro-capitalist, pro-America, Donald Trump, MAGA 2020, whatever. We'll be talking about something where I'll say, you know, why don't we get healthcare benefits for everybody? Why don't we extend the education from, you know, 12th grade through another 4 years of college? And he's like, that's socialism, you know? And it's very cliche, very typical of the boomer generation, but they grew up during a certain time. They saw a certain moment in history where communist or socialist economies caused some major problems. Like, I understand it's okay to be afraid of that, but you also miss out on certain opportunities because you're being so careful. I feel like that's how I am with this topic that you're presenting is, you start talking about mysticism or non-duality or idealism, and I immediately am like, man, this stuff has caused so many problems in the world. Be careful, Andrew. You know, I recognize that I have a little bit of maybe paranoia about it.
Yeah, and I respect that, and I share the same sentiment because, as you know, I was very religious, and when I left my religion, I was told that philosophical materialism is the way things are. That even that philosophical materialism isn't a philosophy. It's just true. And now I view that as another worldview. You may or may not agree with that worldview, but it has a certain set of assumptions and limitations. And there's a historical way of viewing these things. When religion dominated the world, as you're saying, there were all kinds of harms that came from viewing things in terms of supernaturalism and divine revelation. And part of the impetus behind that worldview was suffering, is that people saw the material world as the source of suffering, like the body and sexuality and all of these things. This is the realm of death and suffering. And so there was a lot of denial of the material realm and saying kind of, well, our salvation lies outside of it. The way to escape suffering is through spirituality and divine revelation. That's what we can trust. And so that was kind of one extreme perspective. And I think we've gone away from that. The Enlightenment was in many ways a reaction to this supernaturalist perspective and calling out the harms and religious trauma of that one-sided perspective. But then it kind of went to another extreme in saying, like, all these spiritual experiences are harmful. That's the source of all the religious wars and suffering. And I view this as what's known as psychological splitting. Mm. Psychological splitting is a primitive defense mechanism that humans rely on when they see something as threatening, is we tend to split it off into all or nothing, good or bad, harmful or positive categories. For instance, if somebody, I don't know, cuts me off in traffic, I'll view that, I'll say I hate this person, and all people who drive a red pickup truck are mean people because that guy was riding in a red pickup truck. And, you know, I don't have enough data on that person to say they're all bad or I don't even know them. But that's just what we tend to do, is when we view some kind of experience as threatening or harmful, we split it off into an all bad category, or something as positive, it all good. And this leads to fundamentalism and a kind of myopia. And so this is what happened historically, I think, with the divide between spirituality and materialism. And I think we're on one end of the spectrum. And there are all kinds of harms that come from viewing things in the perspective that we've come to. So kind of flipping the perspective that you just presented, when we view ourselves as disconnected and we're not able to aspect these mystical or spiritual components of ourselves, I know in my life, this resulted in a feeling of isolation, of being alone in a hostile and cold universe, fighting a war against death, having to make all meaning and purpose for myself, and being taught basically that life is about survival of the fittest in many ways. And what I've learned through mystical experiences is that I have a living connection to other beings. Like through this non-dual experiences, that I can experience a connectedness to all things. So in a sense, I'm really not alone, and that there's this deep level of connection and meaning that comes from accessing this greater wholeness that really exists.
Maybe that's my problem then. Maybe, you know, where I was using the analogy of I can't get to the fourth floor. I'm stuck on the third, but there's so many more floors to go. It's not like I see the button in the elevator for the fourth floor or the rest of them above me. It's that that part is almost blurred out from this fear of I'm not going to be skeptical enough anymore. I'm going to be taken for a fool again. I got hurt, man. It screwed me up. That Christian dogmatic fundamentalist bullshit fucked my head up. And once I finally just dropped that backpack of bricks, I felt like I don't want to ever pick up another brick. It's a little scary.
Exactly, it is. And I respect that and relate to that from my own experience. But also, a strictly materialist paradigm comes with its own risks and its own set of potential harms and even traumas. And I would say I experienced it that way. And it's kind of like cutting off access to really the realm of nature and our own nature, our own humanity. And now that I have integrated these powerful experiences, I mean, I'm so much more healthy, so much more whole. And it's just amazing the transformative power of mystical experiences. I mean, that's what's so powerful about something like psychedelics or meditation. In a Johns Hopkins University study, what they've concluded is that it was the mystical experience that people found to be the most powerful and healing aspect of their psychedelic journeys. Like, that is where the healing takes place. That's the therapy. There's a way in which we can keep ourselves, I guess you could say, grounded and safe. Part of it is by just exploring the literature that's out there. So there are vast fields of psychology and science and philosophy that are highly developed around these topics, like transpersonal psychology, like yogic philosophy, Buddhist philosophy, and a lot of it is extremely empirical, very grounded. And one of the themes and calls of our age, I believe, is for an integrative approach, is to really integrate our traditions and apply our critical thinking to spirituality, to shamanism, to mystical experiences, to science, and really look at it critically from both sides. Because it's not critical thinking if we just dismiss all of these types of experiencing in these vast schools of empirical observation just out of our own fear and out of our own trauma. I mean, that's not critical thinking or rationality either.
Do you actually feel one with the universe?
I do, and I have had these kind of experiences, and we could call them, people might refer to this as ego death or a de-individualized state of consciousness, in which we can literally dissolve our sense of a separate self or ego and experience what you could call spirit or pure awareness. And what we've, this experience of being one with all reality, that really our being extends to being itself, extends to all reality. So I have had these non-dual experiences and found them incredibly, incredibly powerful. So I have tasted it, and there are some people who, through spiritual practice, many people actually, who claim to basically live in this state of consciousness on a regular basis, who experience life as basically a flow where there's no separation between their conscious self and the whole of the rest of reality. And that has a lot of implications for the way that we live and experience our life and for our experience of anxiety or separation trauma, some might call it. And a lot of people, when they have this type of non-dual experience, express a huge amount of relief from anxiety and depression through seeing themselves as a part of a greater whole. And this is also connected to a return to nature, or what you might call a Gaia hypothesis. The idea that the universe is not dead inert matter, but it's actually a living organism, that there is more consciousness than just the human psyche, and that maybe even consciousness might be more fundamental than matter. I don't know. That's an open question for me. But we can see our reality in terms of a nested hierarchy of consciousness or a nested hierarchy of organisms. So if we look at a cell in the human body, you could say that that's an individual in a sense, right? Like, maybe if the cell had an experience, it might experience itself as separate from the human body. Mm-hmm. You know, it's right. A self-contained unit. But if we take it to a higher level, we can't really say that that cell is separate from, say, the liver, of which it's a part. But it might not know that or experience that. And then the liver might, it's in some senses self-contained, but it's a part of the greater body. And then the human body and psyche is not separate from the ecosystem in which it lives, or the planet, or the solar system, or the greater cosmos. And if we look at reality, it functions in many ways like a harmonious ecosystem. And so we do have a real sense of individuality, but there is also a way in which we're embedded and connected to the rest of reality. And what all these mystical traditions are saying is that this state, these states of oneness and consciousness, and even experiencing and interacting with other consciousnesses and other intelligences, is possible. It's not something that we are just talking about intellectually here. It's something that people experience regularly through applying these tried and true psycho-spiritual technologies and practices. I don't think it's that far-fetched to say that we're not the only consciousness out there, that there are other intelligences and consciousnesses in nature, that these are actually things that we've experienced and cataloged and studied, even scientifically, although when we have this kind of bias that these things are pseudoscience or because they don't fit in our paradigm, we're likely to ignore them and just not even consider them.
My experience with mindfulness meditation, I found each step of the way, I look at it and go, oh, that was a beneficial step I took. It just took a little courage. And I know that next step is exactly what you're talking about. But whenever you say consciousness is not just an emergent property of matter, perhaps it's more than that, if I'm reading it right. I always think of music. Every time I hear someone say that, I'm right there with you. And then music pops in my head and you lose me, right? We're totally on a different page because I think of, well, music didn't always exist until the violin was played or until the piano was played. And then it's this emergent property of this action. And if I was a musician, I wish, I've tried so many times, but I can't pull it off. But if I was a musician, I might say, you know, music has so much value. It's the core of our existence, right? Because he's going to place more value on music than, say, a chef or an auto worker. Whereas a chef says, you know, it's really about food, or the auto worker says it's about, you know, mechanics and machining and what have you. Maybe we have this bias about our own conscious state because that's what we are. So we're going to look at the universe through that lens, but maybe it's myopic in itself. Is that a possibility?
It is a possibility. And, you know, we can't ultimately prove these things, but I just think there's so much evidence for this that at this point, it's hard for me to ignore, and especially because I'm steeped in these studies and in communities who are experiencing these things, and it's just become a regular part of my life. People often ask me whether I'm an atheist or a theist, and I would say something like neither and both. And I think this is a time to integrate the best of secular and sacred traditions. And really, I follow Einstein here. Einstein spoke a lot about religion and his idea of God. He called himself a religious non-believer and confessed a faith of not knowing. He said, I'm not an atheist. I don't know if I can define myself as a pantheist. So Einstein believed that underlying science was a kind of almost religious conviction of the rationality and intelligibility of a higher order of existence. And he says, this firm belief is bound up with a deep feeling in a superior mind that reveals itself in the world of experience, represents my conception of God. This may be described as pantheistic. So the way I see evolution and just the harmony and beautiful, pristine order of the universe is that it's not purely meaningless and random, that there's more to evolution than survival of the fittest. But if there's something like a God, it's us. That there's this consciousness, this non-dual realm of spirit or consciousness that I've talked about, transcending space and time, that's kind of godlike in a way. And it's possible, I can't prove it, but it might be the case that there's this unified field of consciousness. Maybe there's awareness to it. Maybe there are higher fields of consciousness that our consciousness are combining to be a part of. I don't know, but it's possible that this ideational conscious realm in a way created or unfolded into this realm of dualities, and that part of the process of evolution and spiritual maturation is connecting to our creative godlike potential and connection to the rest of what we might call God or the rest of consciousness and nature and all of reality. So there's these dual processes of involution, which is kind of returning to the primordial state of deindividualized total self, and evolution, which is individuating, finding our separate selves. And this paradoxical process, I think, is kind of like returning to source and then fully differentiating. And it's all part of the same thing. And I found through spirituality, tapping into my creative purpose, my intuition into this non-dual realm, what people use religious metaphors for something like calling or dharma, I find that that's kind of resonates with me in that I come into contact with my intuition, my creativity, a kind of a flow and harmony with my life. A lot of my writings now flow out of my mystical experiences. And so I think there's a lot to explore here. Obviously, it's not proven. I welcome people to question it at all levels, but it's very fascinating stuff. And then we have this world-famous string theorist, Michio Kaku. You've probably seen him on TV and online. He says, "The mind of God, we believe, is cosmic music, the music of strings resonating through 11-dimensional hyperspace."
Wow.
So, really...
That's beautiful.
It is beautiful. And in some ways, we might even say that music is fundamental, in that reality is vibrational or harmonic in a sense. And I think string theory kind of goes there, at least in one sense. I'm not a scientist, but I think that his statement basically reflects this, and that our categories, our conventional categories of matter and spirit might be inadequate. And I mean, we can get into a little bit of science, but I think that really our view of matter has really broken down in a lot of ways. And yeah, so electrons cool. and molecules can be described as elementary particles, and they're the basic units of existence. And they alternate between waveform and a particle form, right?
Sure.
And in waveform, they have no definite position in space-time. They have this kind of potentiality characteristic, and they can transition into material form with a definite location, space, and time. But there is this kind of immaterial space, and quantum mechanics goes into this, where really the space-time boundary isn't there in the way in which we see it. And so in this state of potentiality, they aren't strictly a part of the empirical material realm. When they transition into this more wave-like state of potentiality, they kind of leave the conventional material world. And in the realm of potentiality, elementary particles are in a sense more thought-like than thing-like. They exist in these kind of virtual states as non-material mathematical entities of patterns of information. And so perhaps, I don't know, this is a question, maybe the thought-like nature of a pre-material realm could suggest that consciousness, which forms thoughts, is a kind of cosmic property that might precede matter. I don't know. I mean, this is very speculative, right? And I hear people thinking pseudoscience and new age, which, I mean, I'm kind of okay with, but...
I don't get that from you at all, though. I think you use certain words that might be, you know, like trigger words to the atheist, but I don't get that impression from you in the slightest bit that you aren't legit with this, that this isn't something that is scientific and spiritual for you. Those two things kind of blend together in your perspective.
Exactly. And I think consciousness and matter do blend together and might ultimately be non-separate or non-dual, part of this synchronous, symphonic, musical flow that is existence in a way, where, you know, I'm not really separate from my external reality because it's one living organism in a sense. And that really in this non-dual realm, people describe these experiences as like, it's both light and dark at the same time. It's both living and dead at the same time. It's both one and not one at the same time. And when we talk about these things in intellectual terms, they come across as contradictions or paradoxes because we're flattening like a three-dimensional reality into a two-dimensional space. Right? If we take a 3D image and we draw it on a piece of paper, it's going to lose something of the original because it's impossible to represent it, you know, outside of that dimension. So the best we can do is really use metaphors and paradoxes and kind of say, this isn't that. Because we can only approximate with language, because in the realm of language and personality, it's based on dichotomies. It's based on making judgments and separation. When I'm saying something is black, that means it implies it's not white. There's this way in which language is based on separation, is based on dichotomies. And when we transcend that, when we go to the transpersonal, there is no separation. So in this realm, we can only talk in terms of paradox, and these things appear as contradictions, but when we go beyond it to a higher or more fundamental state of consciousness, those paradoxes really dissolve.
I can't do it, Andrew. I can't. I'm with you 100% that this binary thinking, it's all language-based, and that's why I see me as opposed to the rest of the universe. And I get that this is a somewhat of a social or almost fake construct. I am right now, as you're speaking, I'm barely being able to grasp that this whole thing's kind of illusory. I don't know how to see myself as one with the universe. I don't understand. I don't see that button in the elevator. You know what I mean? It's just not there. I'm pushing at it. I'm trying.
Yeah.
But I just...
Well, I would say you don't have to. And I'm not interested in converting anyone. I mean, I do believe that these perspectives have real implications and are very important, and that when we don't experience our connectivity, that makes it easier for us to harm each other or for us not to live harmoniously. Because if I experience my union with, say, animals and plants or other consciousnesses as a part of my body, it becomes harder for me to harm. Because you don't see many people running around hitting their foot with a hammer. You know, it's a part of my body. So I think that philosophical materialism, to an extreme, can result in capitalistic materialism. Mm-hmm. Because we're separate, right? We don't experience our harmony and connectedness. So there's a way in which that separation leads to this division and wars and different things, whereas if we actually access these parts of being, it just doesn't make sense anymore to do these kinds of things. But really, I don't think we need to force this kind of a thing because it's something that will really evidence itself with time and practice and with experience. And again, there are tried and true methodologies, highly sophisticated and advanced, that are unknown to us in the West because we don't have a mystical school in the philosophical materialist secular tradition. Like pretty much every other school of thought in the East or in shamanic traditions, Buddhism, Advaita Vedanta, Taoism, all of these schools have these highly developed means of spiritual or mystical practice and have integrated these into their thinking. We're at a disadvantage in a way.
Yeah.
Because of that. But I mean, I didn't believe in these things until I was confronted with the experiences. And so I don't ask anyone to believe in these things, but I would say that the experiences are invaluable and powerful, and what you make of them is one thing. But what I do see around me is that there are many, many people who are having these kinds of experiences and are forced to reckon with them scientifically and philosophically, and finds that mystical or psychedelic experiences are worldview altering experiences, and that they force us to ask these kinds of questions about ultimate reality, because people are having experiences of, say, non-material intelligences or union with the rest of nature. And why is that? Why is it that people find themselves compelled to make statements about the ultimate nature of reality and cosmology when they have mystical experiences? You know, is it because it's all a hallucination? Like, why is it that people find themselves doing it? Maybe it's because mystical experiences actually say something about reality that's beyond this individual psyche.
How do you recommend people get psychedelics? And if they were going to try to acquire them, what psychedelics would you recommend they try first?
That's a great question. Psychedelics are being rapidly decriminalized. They were recently decriminalized in Oakland, California, Santa Cruz, California, in Denver, Colorado. And there's a massive movement. Check it out. It's called Decriminalize Nature, that is working to decriminalize them in the whole country. But there are all kinds of psychedelic talks and psychedelic societies being given pretty much everywhere right now. And so I would recommend that people check out these events, plug into the community, and you will meet people who are using these medicines, these psycho-spiritual technologies. It's pretty easy, I think, to find them. You just have to get around and talk to people. And this is happening everywhere. And as far as a first experience, I'm working with Huachuma, or San Pedro. It's a psychedelic cactus, and I think it's a really beautiful introduction because it releases a feeling of bliss or heart opening and euphoria, It's very light and easy and gentle, not like ayahuasca or even mushrooms, which can feel very confrontational or very challenging. People tend not to experience that. It tends to be light and blissful and easy on the body. I mean, not 100% of the time, but most of the time. So I would recommend that. You can always start with a light dose. And I'm actually getting trained to work with these substances. I plan on hosting retreats to help people heal from religious trauma and integrate spirituality. And I'm actually part of a church. It's not really, I mean, it's a church in a sense. We got church status so that we could administer these substances legally, because that's the way you have to do it in the U.S. But it's not dogmatic. It's not based on any kind of a religious perspective. Although, you know, I welcome that. I'm not going to judge anyone. My intention in my work is to present something that's critical of all perspective, but also that can be adopted within them. So if you read my writings, I use religious language or the word God, but I refer to that in kind of a mythological or archetypal sense, like the creativity of the self as it's connected to the rest of reality. And so you can use that within a literalist framework if that's your tradition, or you can use it within an atheistic framework. And I just want to encourage openness and to invite people to have these experiences that are well known to be transformative, to be integrative, to help us heal from our trauma, from our sense of isolation, our chronic separation syndrome, which is really at the core of a lot of psychological ailments, of a lot of physical ailments. And people are finding all kinds of healing from psychological disorders and physical issues too that have psychological roots through these kinds of ceremonies. So I don't think it's that hard to get connected to them, but it's not the only way. Psychedelics aren't the only way. Meditation's a great way. There are many schools of psychology, yogic psychology, which, I mean, is developed out of Indian philosophical and spiritual traditions. And really, this kind of yoga is not about the physical exercise. It's about methods of contemplation and of mystical experiencing. And you'll find a lot of these traditions are very non-dogmatic. They're not prioritizing an intellectual perspective or even a cosmology. A lot of them have their own perspective in cosmology, but again, experience or gnosis is the priority. And so I have a whole lot of books and resources I can also point you to. But I also want to talk about, I guess, like some of my experiences.
Yeah, please.
So this is also something that Carl Jung is a great resource for dealing with mystical experiences and integrating them with science and psychology. He was one of the pioneers of what's now come to be transpersonal psychology. He introduced the term known as synchronicity. And this is very triggering for a lot of people that view it as pseudoscientific. But what it means is that he said that certain events are meaningful coincidences if they occur with no causal relationships, yet seem to be meaningfully related. And so he called it an acausal connecting principle. And so let me give you an example. Recently, I had a dream in which there was a persecutory figure chasing me. And I realized the interpretation of this dream for me kind of intuitively and through meditation. I realized how I was rejecting my experiences in life if they caused me suffering or harm, or if people were mean to me, or not really integrating my experiences of anxiety or evil and just pushing them away. And so I was really running and withdrawing from life. And that's what this meant to me. And before this, I was kind of wishing to experience more of a non-dual integrative perspective in my regular waking consciousness and wondering what it looks like to experience the non-dual in regular waking material consciousness, because non-duality teaches that the realm of separation is also contained within non-duality, that everything we experience as separate is part of this greater whole or movement of the universe or flow that's all not really disconnected at an ultimate level. Kind of the lesson I got from that a non-dual approach to life is opening to the lesson and teaching of every moment, not rejecting any part of my experience. And so I kind of had this inkling that something was going to happen in my life that was going to present me with this challenge. Then the next day in one of my classes, we watched in my Gnosticism class that I'm taking, actually, we watched an episode of The Twilight Zone with someone fleeing from a persecutory figure in their dream. And the lesson was that this person had to open to the fullness of their experience, and instead of trying to fight or hide from it, to accept it. And when they did, their experience of life changed. And then the professor went on to describe what this dream could mean if we had it. And it matched exactly the interpretation that I'd come to the night before. And then in my life, I had this dramatic surprise shift related to my career. I won't get into the specifics of that, but that I kind of felt prepared for. And so, like, you know, you could describe this as just a random kind of coincidence, but, like, I've had enough of these kind of what you could call synchronous experiences where, like, it just becomes impossible for me to dismiss this as random anymore. I view it as non-dual, as part of the flow and connection of consciousness, subjective and objective realms. And so I've really begun to experience a state of where there's kind of like a flow between my dream world, between my consciousness, and between what I experience in the material realm, where there's a lot more of a connection. And another example is that in one of my journeys, I was thinking about, there's a psychiatric medication I've been on for many years, and I'm pretty convinced I don't need it anymore, but it's just been hard to quit. And so I was thinking about, gosh, I really want to quit this. And what came to my mind was a specific person who lives in Austin, and the words Austin, Texas came to my mind. And this person is just a Facebook friend. I barely know them. But I figured, what the hell? I'm going to reach out to them. So I reached out to them and say, hey, I'm wanting to get off this specific drug. I had this impression that I should reach out to you. And she said, like, oh my gosh, I was just in this medicine journey space too when you had contacted me. And I just quit this same psychiatric medicine recently. And I can tell you about my experience and some advice. So, you know, that to me is a synchronicity. Like, I mean, so you could hold the position that that was just random and coincidental, but it's very, very strange for me. Like, I just can't do that anymore because I have so many of these kinds of experiences that people will use the word like psychic to describe. And again, these things are well studied. There's a whole field, parapsychology, terapsychology, transpersonal psychology, you know, yogic psychology and philosophy that document these kinds of experiences that people have. And they're just flatly discounted, again, by people because of their set of assumptions.
You don't think that these are just patterns of events that you're remembering the hits and forgetting the misses, that it's all just kind of a pattern from your brain in a way?
I don't. And the idea that psychedelics or mystical experiences are just drugs or events occasioning brain states is a minority paradigm when it comes to communities that have studied these states of consciousness and practices and medicines. Like, pretty much very, very few people who are in these traditions hold that perspective. Like, you'll be hard pressed to meet shamans who hold that perspective. I mean, I'm sure there are some, but so one of the reasons that I came to this perspective is that these experiences are all things that many of them are things that I've never seen before. Like, I'm positive that a lot of the kinds of experiences I have on psychedelics or in mystical states are not something my brain just dreamed up. Like, I literally have never been exposed to them before, and I was 100% opposed to their existence, in fact. So people will regularly have experiences of what they'll describe as entities of non-material intelligences or forms of life. And people also describe these plant medicines or psychedelics as having a literal intelligence to them, i.e. that it's not just a chemical, there's a chemical component, but that there's a kind of intelligence of the plant or an entity or a higher form of consciousness that guides the healing, which is why people tend to have these mind-blowing revelations that are not things that you had thought of before. And so just through all the accumulated experience, like, these are not things that I had ever been exposed to. And again, like, a lot of these cosmologies and statements about reality that these divergent mystical schools make are very similar. There's actually a lot of consensus about some of the statements I'm making. Like, there are differences. I'm not going to say they all agree, but a lot of them do agree on many of the fundamentals.
The whole concept is absolutely beautiful to me, and it's a place that feels more true than the place that I'm at, this, you know, post-enlightenment stage, very materialistic kind of zone that I'm existing in. This feels fake to me, you know, it really does. It doesn't feel as legitimate as seeing everything as one, because I know that it is to some extent, where maybe I'm not at a place to receive it yet.
I don't think, you know, anyone needs to be. Again, like, it's about, I think, embracing our process and where we're at, and like, I don't think we need to force anything, but if you find these kinds of mystical experiences transformative, which I have, I found them to be more healing, more integrative, more empowering than anything else, pretty much, that I've done, right alongside psychotherapy, maybe. So I think the benefit is one thing, but then I think that I found, too, that spirituality or consciousness or this great connectivity, this kind of web of aliveness and connectedness or oneness, that what it does to me is it connects me to a deeper core of who I am, something that's deeper than my body, mind, regular state of consciousness. And that when I'm connected to that, I understand my meaning and purpose. I get this core sense of aliveness and like the way I should live my life that best aligns with my deepest self and sense of meaning kind of comes to me intuitively and naturally, and life becomes more of a flow state. There's less anxiety and striving and grasping. All of these, this healing and wholeness really happens naturally because it is the essence of nature. And we're connecting with both our core nature and the nature of nature itself. Which is really one thing. So I think for people developing a mystical practice, follow your own path, pay attention to your own wisdom and the wisdom that life presents you. Keep an open mind, but keep a critical mind. But there are so many different mystical and spiritual practices from so many different traditions. Really, whatever suits you. You know, what suits me might not suit you. Some people might be drawn to more of a kind of ascetic, disciplinarian type practice. Some might be more drawn to more pleasure-based or more embodiment-based practices. The world is really your oyster.
That's great advice, and I fully intend to take it. Andrew, thank you so much. And anybody that's wanting to look into this a little bit more, lifeafterdogma.org. I really appreciate your time today, and I appreciate you passing on some wisdom our way.
It's been a pleasure.
Thank you to Andrew. Thank you to Dave Blair at DaveBlairMusic.com. Thank you to our patrons. You can also support this broadcast at patreon.com/right and learn more at therighttoreason.com. The coronavirus has recently taken music legend Bill Withers. He will certainly be missed. It's the coronavirus that we will be talking about next week. We have a broad panel of guests to discuss this unprecedented time that we're living in. Between now and then, remember that you have the right to reason. When the day that lies ahead of me seemed impossible to face.